Friday, February the 3rd, I at least had slept rather well. For both of us these days, that's the hardest thing to come by. In the morning, I worked with Bess and Liz a while, and then began a long day with the library. First, I met with Dr. Harry Ransom in the Queen's sitting room and put before him the problem of Dr. Grover, who has been invited to go to Iran to work on some of that governmental programs by the Executive Corps, the so-called Paunch Corps. I feel that for the Lyndon Johnson Library, we must have an acting director during the 2 years that it's in the building process. One central head to bring problems of acquisitions, architecture, personnel, everything too. Otherwise, we're just a lot of interested people giving some volunteer time when and as we can in a haphazard sort of fashion. We need one man at the head. Working as a part-time consultant for the GSA to oversee the library is not a satisfactory condition for Dr. Grover. Dr. Ransom agreed, understood, and felt that it would be easily possible for the university to hire him for this 2-year intermediate period, and he said he would talk to him before the day is over. And then we gathered in the tree room, Dr. Ransom and Dr. Grover and Dorothy T. Rito, Juanita Roberts, and last, rather late, Mary Lasker, for our second meeting of the Acquisitions Committee. My main news was that Dr. Grover had drafted and the President had approved a letter for the Chief Archivist to send out to members of the administration at the level of Assistant Secretary and above, inviting them to leave their papers to the Lyndon Johnson Library. Juanita Roberts had a list, and prodigious it was, those past and present since he came in on November the 22nd of 63. She said she would take over from there. And then we discussed the 10 main fields of Lyndon's endeavors in his governmental career. The social revolution, with all its ramifications, its chief one, civil rights, medical research, new surge forward in education, space, and we talked about having a subcommittee on acquisitions for each of these 10. For instance, Mary could head the one on medical research, decide on the people who were not in the government who had worked in that field, for instance, Dr. DeBakey, whom we might want to invite to leave their papers. As Dr. Grover says, you spread a wide net and get a mighty few fish. And yet I myself can testify that to be asked is taken as a compliment. I know I beam whenever I think that Radcliffe asked me for my papers. I never thought I'd have anything worth leaving. And of course, they will go to our library. Nevertheless, we should start asking, and soon. There's a lot of talk about the field of personal friends who might throw light on Lyndon's career and works. For instance, Sam Foer. And as in most committees, more talk than clear-cut decisions. And then Dr. Ransom gave a brief report on acquisitions of the University of Texas since our last meeting in October. These included the Jesse Jones personal collection, a draft of Travis's letter from Alamo, and a manuscript of the Treaty of Velasco, and the first portrait of Stephen F. Austin by an itinerant German artist, and all of Stephen F. Austin's books. Many, many things will be adjacent, but not in, the Lyndon Johnson Library. We all got excited and caught up in it, and I was always conscious of the setting. There we were, in a room where the Cabinet of the United States met for about 37 years, using their cabinet table, which had also been used only last week to sign the space treaty on, putting out our cigarettes and Mrs. Rutherford B. Hayes' funny hand-painted china dishes, and I was sitting in Grover Cleveland's big presiding chair. An interesting midwifery for our presidential library. At 1 o'clock, we went down for lunch on the first floor so as not to get in the way of what was happening in the family dining room upstairs, and then wound up our business a little before 3, and Mary Lasker left to go to Mrs. Philip Barry's to see her portrait of me. But that was only the first meeting of the day about the library. At 3, Max Brooks joined us with an enormous rolled-up sheaf of plans. We spread them out on the cabinet table. Bob Fleming came over to give his advice on the space allotted for the press. And we went over the executive floor, which has been pretty much redone by Juanita, which Max wants to take and refine along the lines she laid down of the way people come in, wait, go in, and exit. The first floor is, I believe, very much improved. as a result of our objections last fall. There's now more lobby and exhibition space. The restrooms are downstairs. There's a clear line of demarcation between what the GSA administers and what the university uses. I'm still concerned about the Great Hall and completely inadequate to direct or solve it. Dr. Grover is leaving on the 15th, and my main desire was to get every expression of any needed change in the plans that he, a Juanita, a Dorothy Torito, or Leonard Marks from the audiovisual field, or anybody, can give to Max before we all turn our attention to other things and Dr. Grover is gone and the plan is all firmed up and after a while encased in steel and concrete and beyond change. It's very exhausting to try to think hard about something that you're not knowledgeable in, and I discovered that I was exhausted when they left a little before 5. I spent a few minutes going over the cards for the ambassador's wives that I was going to receive. Mrs. Boonstra, whose husband is going to Costa Rica, and Mrs. Peyton to the Republic of the Cameroons, and Mrs. John Henning to New Zealand, and Mrs. David King, whom I had known in Congress for years, to the Malagasy Republic. I went down at 5. We met in the green room, the fire going merrily, and the tea table set prettily. Katie Lockheim was there, with one more wife, Mrs. Green, whose husband has been our ambassador in that country of tumultuous change, Indonesia. And there followed as interesting an hour as I've ever spent in this job. Mrs. Green proved the most articulate and, of course, had the most exciting stories to tell about being left with one Marine to guard her in the embassy while her husband was down at the chancery and mobs were howling in the street with torches and cars were being turned over and set fire right out in front of the embassy. In the nick of time, the army made its decision to guard the American embassy and arrived with guns and barbed wire emplacements. She gave you the feeling of having been there and of the thread upon which that whole country hangs. I had lots to talk about with Mrs. Henning about the beautiful wildflowers of New Zealand and the Governor General who could stride right onto the stage as a character out of Kipling, an Edwardian Governor General with his white clipped mustache and his monocle. She was very proper and ladylike, and will, I think, be at home there, whereas Mrs. David King, with her 8 children, 6 their own, 2 adopted, 1 part Tunisian, 1 German, and her young, breezy air, she is, I believe, a Mormon and a true descendant of those pioneers who crossed the mountains and the desert in a covered wagon and on foot, and I think will be quite equal to whatever ardors that Malagasy Republic holds. The wives who had served abroad had interesting tales of the things you needed to take. How cake mix was the most prized delicacy and the biggest treat in many countries was to invite the citizens of it over for a cake and a movie. And how when you got back to the USA, the thing you wanted most of all was milk because you couldn't get a fresh drop to drink in X country or X country. It was a prized hour of understanding for me, of what goes on in serving our country. A little after 6, I said goodbye and went upstairs, and Linda Bird came breezing in from New York, and we talked of her week, of book collecting, of a delightful dinner where she'd met a British Earl, who was an extremely interesting and cultivated man, a cultural advisor to some administration, and danced at the 21. I went to the bowling alley alone and played 3 games, rather well on 1, 153 score, and then back for some paperwork. Brendan did not come for dinner until after 10, and we sat and talked for about 40 minutes about his day. It's like plowing through mud these days, frustrating and difficult, and over, it seems to me that just to get up in the morning and go ahead with your work is the greatest courage. Finally, the 3 of us ate just before 11, and I went to bed.